walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Philip Jenny, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, one of the largest and busiest wildlife medical centers in the nation, treating upwards of 9,000 wild animals annually, representing more than 180 different species. We'll discuss the center, its history and evolution, some of the animals they've treated, and more when we speak with Phil Jenny in just a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Also, towards the end of today's show, in Name That Animal Tune, we'll be offering as the prize a pair of tickets to see Johnny Marr at the Beecham Theater in Orlando, November 25th. We'll get to all this later in the program. First, let's hear an animal song. This is the Eels with I Like Birds on Talking Animals.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds. I don't care for walking downtown, crazy auto car gonna mow me down. Look at all the people like cows in a herd. Well, I like birds. You're small and on a search, I've got a feeder for you to perch on. I can't stand in line at the store, the mean little people are such a bore. But it's alright if you act like a turd, 'cause I like birds.
This is the Eels with I Like Birds, animal song to get us started. All right, let's get to our discussion with Phil Jenny, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Philip Jenny back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I enjoy your show, and I'm always impressed by your guests, so I hope I can take up a good hour here.
All right. Well, flattery will get you everywhere there, Phil. So so let's kind of start with the basics, kind of expanding on my glib descriptive phrase at the top of the show. Tell us a little bit about the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, just fundamentally. What is it, and what does it do?
WRC, as we like to call ourselves, is a veterinary hospital for injured and orphaned wild animals. So So basically, we take care of all of the animals that are injured and found by individuals. We don't go and get anything. Everything that comes to us is brought in to us by members of the public. We also have a real robust professional education program for veterinary students and also pre-vet students and others who are interested in kind of more global natural resource management issues. So basically, it's just a free emergency 911 for animals.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll probably expand on most, if not all, those points. But let's trace the timeline a little bit. I mean, there's quite a history and sort of evolution to the WRC, as you call it, and undergone some notable permutations over the years. So maybe not moment by moment, obviously, but maybe just starting with the birth of the center, maybe you could just sort of describe sort of initially what prompted the founding of it, and then kind of how it unfolded from there to where we find ourselves now.
Sure. It's actually an interesting story that is kind of repeated across the country in various permutations. We started in 1979 as a student organization at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. A couple years before that, 1977, a couple of faculty members from the university's vet school founded the now world-famous Raptor Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very interested in, particularly at that time, it was the restoration of the peregrine falcons and the threat to bald eagles and other raptors from DDT. And but there were students on campus who felt, well, gee, there's all these little birds and squirrels and rabbits and other things in our backyards that aren't getting the care they need. So they founded the organization in 1979. That first year, they treated 40 animals. That's kind of a not very busy morning for us now during the middle of our busy season. But I also think it's kind of interesting, if you look at the kind of the larger cultural issues around in the late 70s, there was really kind of a sea change happening in lots of areas that dealt with the environment. The vet world particularly was changing tremendously from largely what they called the producer animals and, the Dr. Harriet kind of thing, James Harriet profile of the veterinary. The veterinarian who traveled to farms and that too. And all of a sudden there was this influx of women into the professional fields, and particularly into vet medicine. And I think with them they brought a broader sense of compassion. And at the same time it was also kind of a back-to-nature movement and a lot of challenges from just the changing economy. And if you look at throughout history, really, whenever there's these kind of large-scale changes in economies like the Industrial Revolution and other things like that, it's always accompanied by a back-to-nature movement. And I think that we're sort of part of that larger movement. And in fact, in the first decade or so in the 80s, we grew pretty rapidly until by the mid-90s, the university's vet school thought that we no longer really fit as a profile of a student organization. So we were asked to leave and went off as a private nonprofit organization stayed on the university campus until 2002 when we built a new facility only about 4 or 5 miles from the campus. It's interesting, though. We were in an old, partially condemned building at the university, and when we built our new facility and moved 5 miles away, the university vet school actually took us a lot more seriously than when we were right in their backyard. So it's sort of like a consultant who's 50 miles from home with a briefcase.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way we were, the new facility.
Wow. So
gave us a lot of oomph.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's sort of sounds like some version of familiarity breeding some kind of contempt. Because what exactly, when you were sort of, I guess, politely or maybe not so politely, invited to leave, what was it that they felt about the WRC that didn't really fit the profile, since, as you've already alluded to, and I want to delve into this a bit more in a few minutes, that the center does provide training for vet students and pre-vet students. So what was their thinking at that moment where they said, hey, you guys really sort of don't fit here with what we're doing?
I wasn't here at that time, so. Uh-huh. But but from what I know, the oral history of it is kind of a combination of things. One, the vet school was, like a lot of colleges and universities, really looking to focus more. So it was looking at what its core competencies were. And at the same time, there was a lack of support from the upper echelons of the administration, particularly the dean, who this just wasn't his thing. And the fact that we were most of the people and the volunteers and obviously all of the customers were just members of the public and were coming from the outside, so they really weren't part of the university. And finally, there was the issue with space. I mean, we had really outgrown our space. No other place on campus for us, and in the building we were in, the university either wanted to remodel or tear down, which they've since torn it down. So it just, you know, kind of a combination of
things. I see. Yeah, so it wasn't quite as, hey, get the heck out, as it,
no.
It sounded like there was a variety of factors that included get the heck out, but it wasn't
there,
that.
There was a bit of that. In fact, President Yudof at the time, he had some smart public relations people who said to him, you can't do this. They're going to put little, you know, tiny furry animals out on the curb in January and say, look what the university's doing to us.
Right. There's no place for these guys to go.
Yeah. So they realized that they needed to do this smartly.
Sure. Well, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Phil Jenny, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, one of the largest and busiest such facilities in the country. If you'd like to ask Phil a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, Phil, so it's funny that the vet school said, hey, it doesn't really work for us, and now training vet students and pre-vet students, or at least giving them experiences like that, is kind of a critical part of the operation, if I understand it. In what ways does the center, being something at least of a teaching facility, shape how it's run or some of its policies?
Well, I think we see that as an important part of our mission. Our mission is really twofold. It's one, to provide quality medical care for injured animals. And then the second part of our mission is sharing our knowledge with the people who care. And the way we look at that is, you know, some wildlife centers and places like us will have what are called education animals, animals that aren't able to be released but are used to take to school groups and other kind of public settings to create awareness of you know, broader issues with animals. Our vision is not to do that. We think there are plenty of those places, and in fact, we share our space here, not physically, but we are in a park, in a Roseville Park, with a nature center. So you can argue about whether nature centers do a good job educating kids. What we do know is that there's very little professional education about what is really a vastly fast-growing field in wildlife medicine. So for us, strategically, we feel that educating veterinary students and pre-vet students in wildlife medicine is a unique niche where we have a core competency. So
sure.
It definitely shapes our vision of the organization.
Right. And again, it sounds like it's a fairly singular opportunity for people that are studying to become vets.
Absolutely. There's very little wildlife curriculum in vet schools around the country.
Yeah.
And it's also an opportunity. And vet school is very rigorous. And students will tell you the first few years, they don't even really touch an animal. It's mostly all classroom stuff. So we can actually provide, with our opportunities, those vet students to actually get up close to animals as well. So I think it aids their studies quite a bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would think that would be a huge appeal for those students, because, again, you know, there's, you know, vet schools obviously around the country, but I would think very, very few of them could possibly offer this element that the WRC does to their vet school education. So
yeah, there's a, like, we treat the 100. Last year was 184 different species of animals.
Wow!
So you start thinking about that, you know, and seven, oh, more than 70 of those were either one or two of a species. So we might only see something like a blue-spotted salamander. We might only see one every 5 or 10 years, or a bobcat, or something like that. So the uniqueness is really fascinating too. Very challenging.
For sure. All right. Well, I have plenty more questions, but we do have a caller who looks like they have a question for you. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Phil Jenny.
Hi there. I had a question. I used to live in Minnesota, and I know hunting and trapping are popular activities there. I was wondering how these activities affect your end of it, as far as what do you see as far as injured animals from such activities as hunting and trapping.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We don't really see much directly from that. I think probably the only case in the last 10 years where there was a direct connection between trapping and a patient is somebody was trapping beavers, and he had trapped the mom and then discovered that there were some babies left behind, and he actually brought the three baby beavers in, and they now live at the Henry Doorly Zoo in Omaha because they weren't releasable, so we placed them. But it doesn't really affect us much. Most of the patients that we get are have some kind of human interaction and collision, but thankfully I'd have to say that the great majority of them are inadvertent collisions, that we don't see a whole lot of acts of wanton destruction of wildlife or somebody who's actually going out of their way to hurt animals. We do see some of that, of course, but very little from the hunting and trapping community.
All right, thanks. Thanks so much for your call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Phil Jenny.
Yeah, man, I just thank your guest and yourself, because really caring about non-pet animals is a pretty big evolutionary leap for humans, who tend to be selfish and are lacking in empathy and compassion and the ability to feel the suffering of all of the native animals not made by humans, who are just being overrun by human population growth and development. So as you go about your work, you're in the business of increasing empathy and compassion and really a respect for other species who are in their own ways just as valuable as the human species. And that I wish that more funding would come to you from government and private sources. And I wish this program and your guest all the best. You're doing what the Buddhists call right livelihood, and we thank you for it.
Wow. Well, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. That's basically taken right from some of my fundraising letters. We have a website that people can actually donate on. So
yeah, well, let's just talk about that.
I couldn't agree more with the caller.
Right. So the website is wrcmn.org. And there's all kinds of information, and one of the things that I mentioned just when I was just sort of plugging the show at the end of the Cool Morning and Music Show, Phil, I made brief reference to the critter ticker, so maybe we'll come back to that. But if somebody, anybody does visit the website, one of the many things that you'll find there is the so-called critter ticker. That's sort of like a Twitter feed that tracks new patients effectively and what day and even what time they've come in. So so with that in mind, Phil, in fact, let's really get more specific about what really goes on at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. I mean, I have to assume, given the nature of the work there, that every day is different. There's no such thing as a typical day, and that's probably part of what makes it fun and exciting and challenging. But maybe just to give us a more specific sense of the operation, maybe you could run down, if not a typical day, then maybe a composite of a couple of days, or maybe if something notable or illuminating happened yesterday, for example, just sort of maybe walk us through some of the key elements of any given day.
Sure. It's our business is really seasonal because of just the seasonal nature of animals. So a typical day in the middle of the summer is vastly different than a typical day in November. Mm-hmm. But for an example, is the end of last June, and this is fairly typical of any summer day, the Twin Cities was raked by a series of strong thunderstorms. And what happens in thunderstorms like that, depending on when they come, and when they come in late June, there's a lot of birds nesting. So all of a sudden, a lot of tree limbs are down, a lot of, we had strong winds, a lot of baby birds blown out of their nests, a lot of animals killed, animals on the ground like rabbits with kind of flash flooding, their burrows are flooded, and other kinds of animals that live in the underneath the ground. And in days like that, we are just literally flooded with animals. We took in about 450 animals over a two-day period during that storm. So
wow.
That's kind of an all hands on deck. At mm-hmm. that point, we've got about 70 interns, college-age interns here. We've got about 600 volunteers. And during the summer, we've got about 20 staff members. So all of those animals, every one of them, no matter how small or no matter how injured, gets an exam by a veterinarian. And at the end of that exam, whatever they need, whether their injuries are so bad that they have to be euthanized or if they're, fine, except they've lost their parent, they're all then moved through the building into the appropriate area and then cared for by either somebody in the nurseries or somebody in our year-round animal care crew. This time of year is a lot different. We see a lot of migratory animals. We see a lot more large waterfowl. We'll see trumpeter swans, pelicans. And there, each of those animals probably has something that is a little bit more mysterious clinically than just getting blown out of a nest. So a trumpeter swan that comes in this time of year, for instance, is going to go through a battery of tests, a test for lead poisoning. We'll do radiographs to see if there's any lead in its stomach, a variety of things like that. And those animals tend to also take up more space. Trumpeter swan, it takes, we can have 200 baby birds in the same room that one trumpeter swan is.
Wow, yeah.
So we really change the whole nature of the business changes. But what doesn't change is that every animal that comes in gets the same kind of care from a veterinarian that your dog or cat would get if you went to your veterinarian.
So it really sounds like when they first get there, as you say, a vet sees every single animal, and then it does sound like some sort of triage, not unlike you would have in a human's,
right,
ER. And then is the protocol typically driven more by what sort of animal it is than what sort of injury or ailment, or
yes,
just some sort of matrix of the two, or how does that work?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's some mix, but primarily, especially during the orphan season, it's driven by the species. So we'll keep all the baby squirrels together, we'll keep all the baby rabbits together, we'll keep all the baby fox together. We'll try to, and each of them will have a different protocol in terms of how long they're here, what their diet is. And, when you think about it, last year we had about 50 different species of songbirds. And they all eat differently. And so, for instance, with swallows and swifts and bug-eating animals that are birds that eat on the wing, that is, they don't perch to eat, we actually then have to put them in a position where their instincts allow them to succeed. So we'll have volunteers who are actually waving bugs, and we have a vendor called the Bug Company that we spend $5,000-$6,000 every month during the busy season with.
Wow.
buying meals and crickets and mealworms and grubs and stuff. And so we'll just hold those in, and in these flight rooms, the birds will actually have to learn to eat on the wing. Robins and other ground feeders, we set them up in dirt so they have to dig for the worms and things. So, yeah, it's very much driven by what the animal needs and
mm-hmm.
how we can make that animal successful when it's released back in the wild. With adult animals, it's a little different because they've already established territories. They've established, you know, they are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, too, we try to replicate as much as we can the environment they came from, but at the same time keeping them safe.
Right. So it sounds like unstated, but I guess probably obvious, objective is one way or another to get that animal healthy enough to be released. I mean, it's always about releasing.
Right.
But you, as you mentioned in one of the responses to one of the callers, sometimes that's not possible if they're too injured or incapacitated, I guess, to be returned to the wild. So you mentioned in that example, one went to a zoo. I mean, what are some of the other scenarios? And you know, what first of all, what are some of the things that prevent an animal from being released back to the wild? And then in some of those cases, where might they go, I guess, depending on their circumstance?
Sure. If you look at birds especially, if they have any kind of permanent damage to the wing or any of the flight structure, they're not going to survive. And actually, both state and federal law require in those circumstances that in our judgment, releasing the animal to the wild means it won't survive, we are required to humanely euthanize the animal. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you think about, go outside and try to catch something, a squirrel or a raccoon or a bird or something, there's no chance, you know, if you're going to catch it by hand. And then think about an animal that you can walk up to, put in a box, and bring into us. It's badly injured for it to do that because they have no, like the other caller said, they have no concept. They're not domestics. They think that people are a predator and want to eat them. So
sure.
It's very, very stressful occasion for them to actually get picked up by somebody and brought into us and then handled here. So in a lot of cases, many of the animals are really badly hurt. And
mm-hmm.
in those cases, if they're not releasable in our judgment, their injuries are such that they're not going to recover, we will euthanize them. There's a network of zoos and other exotic placement things where there might be somebody. Here in Minnesota, for instance, the Minnesota Zoo has what's called the Minnesota Trail, and it's mostly Minnesota native animals. And we've actually placed several animals in our zoo here. Our standard for that is in our judgment, they can't be in pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to tell. Animals don't tell you how they feel.
Sure, yeah.
But in our judgment, we have to think that the injury is something that is, while it prevents them from being releasable, it does not cause them pain. And they're the kind of species that can at least survive in an exotic or zoo-type environment. Not every animal it really fits that profile.
Sure.
Loons, for instance, the Minnesota state bird, it just does not do well in captivity. They almost always will die. So we do very little placement there.
Yeah. So again, it's very much species by species, case by case, and what the ailment, injury, et cetera, is, and then mm-hmm. making a determination from there. How big of an area, Phil, are people sort of drawing from, in a sense, when they do bring you an animal that, or a bird, or whatever it might be? I mean, is there a certain scope that is clearly within the sort of the purview of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, and then outside of that, that would be either a different facility or just, hey, we can't necessarily respond to every animal that comes in from all the reaches that people might find an animal like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Our core, of course, comes from the metropolitan Minneapolis-St. Paul area,
mm-hmm.
where most of our animals come in probably a 60 to 70 mile radius from our center. It is interesting, though, and always humbling to see people who will drive 4 or 5 hours with an injured animal, sometimes as, you know, ordinary as a squirrel or a snake, or, you know, we've seen that, and it's really quite astonishing and inspiring for us to see those circumstances. The states are increasingly concerned, wildlife officials in most states are increasingly concerned with with translocation of animals, and they're afraid of disease being spread by animals. So what, most states are not able to either accept or release animals from outside the state jurisdiction.
Okay.
We actually have a variance here in Minnesota to accept because of our proximity to Wisconsin. We have a variance in our permit that allows us to admit animals from Wisconsin, and actually Iowa and both Dakotas. And in this last year, we've had animals from North Dakota and Iowa and lots of them from Wisconsin, actually, western Wisconsin. So, you know, again, the core is the Twin Cities area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in some ways, it's an urban business in a way. I mean, a lot of people, particularly in rural areas, are just a little bit more used to animals and dying and all those sorts of things that are somewhat unique to farm culture.
Yeah.
So, but I think it's, you know, as the other caller said about the big evolutionary leap for humans, I think that there is starting to be a sense that sometimes it's not just about the squirrel, it's about the act of compassion and the act of rescue that motivates people.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I was thinking about that earlier. Let me just again remind folks, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Phil Jenny, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. Just wondering, over the years, what sort of experiences you've had with, I mean, on the one hand, you've got the people that you just mentioned that drive 4 or 5 or more hours to bring you some sort of injured or ill animal. But then what kind of experiences have you had with members of the public or whoever who might question spending money, time, maybe resources on certain animals? I mean, since you mentioned the squirrel, I'll go with that. Like, you know, hey, you're putting all this into a squirrel. You know, at my house, a squirrel is considered a nuisance, or, you know, whatever it might be. Do you find those kinds of attitudes at times? Or?
Oh, sure, we do. We don't. I mean, we're a self-selecting population, though, so those people are out there. We probably don't run into them much because they don't bother to bring a squirrel in.
Right, right. No, but I guess I meant more like when it comes to sort of the operation and budgeting some of the things that go with funding an operation like that. I wondered if there's people who would squawk, so to speak, at what sorts of things where the resources are devoted.
Yes, right, and I think that's true. And curiously, the natural resource management people, wildlife biologists, have often been at the forefront of that thinking that you know, it's just a squirrel, and there's, you know, too many or not enough or whatever. I think gradually, though, even in that group of people, the attitudes are shifting. While they might not be necessarily pro-rehabilitation, I think many of them have now grown to see the value of the opportunity for learning for young people, and just that a compassionate public is more likely to support much of their work as well. I think that is something that we do talk about a lot, but you know, we're an emergency hospital. You know, we don't make judgments on the animals that come in.
Right. If they're there, you respond.
That's right.
Yeah.
Know, we're not in population control, so it's not up to us to decide if there are enough squirrels or not. And you know, and the other thing is that we don't really have any broader, I think, effect on populations. You know, there's a few species that we might move the needle on, but for the most part, even with our large numbers, they're pretty minuscule in the bigger aspect of populations.
Sure.
So we don't have much effect on the population, but we think we have an effect, of course, on the animal that comes in.
Right.
But more importantly, we have a huge impact on the people who do rescue the animal. You know, this is a pretty unique thing. There aren't that many people who actually get that opportunity. So when they have that opportunity, and it's all kinds of, we're a demographer's nightmare. There is no standard customer.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, it really is pretty interesting that people want to help. And again, I think that instinct for compassion is something that just repeated over time, or repeated behavior over time, that really does move the needle culturally,
yeah,
not on the population side.
Well, and with that in mind, there's sort of two at least sides to that. There's the folks that do, in some cases, go to great lengths to bring in whatever injured animal or bird. But the center also relies on a huge squadron of volunteers. Maybe you could describe how the volunteers get involved there, and you know, what sort of training they maybe undergo, and then what sort of tasks they might carry out in any given day.
Yeah, that's a really good point. A lot of times I think people, their entry might be they have rescued something and they think, oh gee, I'd really like to do this, so they explore volunteering. Other people will, some of them are more vocationally interested, so we might get a fair amount of students who are going to be going into some natural resource thing who want to actually volunteer. And then we also have a lot of retired people who are just looking for something meaningful to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not work for the faint-hearted. It's not, you know, cuddling baby bunnies. It's difficult work. We do require that everybody who works with rabies vector mammals have rabies shots and tetanus shots, and kind of almost like the same thing you'd have to go through for international travel.
Mm.
And a lot of it is handling, learning how to handle wild animals, learning about what we give the instructions about any kind of food and, you know, how much and all that sort of stuff. But to be honest with you, it's a lot of husbandry. It's a lot of cleaning poop out of cages.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
Putting food in cages.
Right, right.
And I think that so there's a lot of, and we also don't allow any of the volunteers to talk to the animals. Back to your original point, that the goal here is to get the animals out back into the wild. We don't want them to be too accustomed to people,
mm-hmm.
nor do we want them to be afraid, because, again, they're afraid of us. So
sure.
We want to be kind of seen and not heard.
Right, keep their instincts in place and
right.
not kind of,
yep.
you know, blow any circuits, I guess, in there.
Yeah, and so that kind of, again, then the people self-select. We have a fairly rigorous orientation schedule, and at that point people can say, you know what, this isn't really what I really want to do. There's a lot of safety requirements, you know, in terms
mm-hmm.
of there's a lot of the potential disease, so we're always careful to make sure that our volunteers are protected, as well as not transferring disease from animal to animal. But it's really interesting. We have a lot of volunteers. We have some volunteers who've been here 15 years or more.
Wow.
Which really tells you that this is something that they feel strongly about. And we get some tire kickers. People come in and they're here for 6 weeks or so and say, wow, this is not what I thought.
This is not for me. Thank you. Yeah.
Exactly. But increasingly, in the last few years, I'd have to say we really haven't had any problem attracting enough good volunteers. That hasn't been an issue lately.
And am I right in thinking that at any given moment that there's somewhere between 400 and 500 volunteers that are serving the WRC?
Yeah, in the summertime we have about 600 regular volunteers.
Wow.
and then plus the students. This time of year, when we're really only caring for adult animals, there's about 140.
I see,
and
yeah.
They're not obviously here all at one time. We have
right.
two shifts a day during this time of year, and
sure.
the shift has about 10 members on it.
Right, underscoring again that it's extremely seasonal there.
Seasonal.
So your description of the patients a little bit and how that works, and some of the vet students, et cetera, and then obviously the volunteers kind of has helped, I think for me at least, and hopefully for the listeners, kind of demystify how things would work at the WRC. Well, what it's hard for me to have a precise sense of is how commonplace such centers are. Like how many counterparts are there to the WRC sort of scattered around, and where are they?
Most urban areas have some kind of a center
okay.
similar to ours, and they're also somewhat geographically located. In some cities, the model is that the Humane Society has a wildlife area. So, for instance, the Milwaukee Humane Society has most of the wildlife. I think they treat about 3,000 animals at the Milwaukee Humane Society through their, I can't remember exactly what their the name of theirs is. Mm. The other model is similar to what we were originally, which is to have a vet school have a wildlife center associated with it. So Tufts University is a very good veterinary school.
Sure.
That's a wildlife component. They have a wildlife hospital. Then there are independent centers like ours around the country.
Yeah.
Wildlife Center of Virginia is a very notable center. There's a lot of down in the Gulf Coast states.
Mm-hmm.
Florida has the Center for the Rehabilitation of Wildlife.
Right.
GROW. There's a South Florida version that actually they're partnered with the Nature Conservancy in Southwest Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Suncoast Seabird Sanctuary, which treats as many animals as we do, but all seabirds.
Right, of course, yeah.
And then the West Coast has got quite a range all the way from Seattle down to Bainbridge Island has a center. There's a couple notable ones, Paws out in the Portland area.
Yeah.
So there's a few like that. But again, they tend to have a couple of characteristics. They're either partnered with the Humane Society, they're partnered with a vet school,
mm-hmm.
or they are in a coastal region that sees a lot of wildlife.
Sure. Makes sense. Otherwise, it seems like it'd be too kind of isolated, or there just wouldn't be enough kind of support or resources.
Yeah. I'm not aware of any big wildlife centers in Wyoming.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, Phil, I think we just about reached the end of our time, but I mean, I think this is really interesting, and yeah, there are others out there, but you know, I sort of like to cast a pretty big net on the show in terms of covering different kinds of issues and speaking to different kinds of folks, and like our one of those nice callers pointed out, I mean, this is really important work. That's the kind of thing that could slide under a lot of people's radar that do care about animals and animal issues. So we appreciate you making the time. This has been Phil Jenny, Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota. Again, the website is wrcmn.org, and they're also on Facebook at the same with the same letters, WRCMN. So thanks so much, Phil.
Thank you very much, Duncan. Look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye now. All right, we'll going to hear probably another animal tune shortly. Right now, let's deck into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner with owls and wildlife of various stripes in mind. Let's hear this one from Matt Bronger, part of a piece indeed called Owls, on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Anyway, Harry Potter. Like, I like them. I like the books. I like the movies. But I think they send the wrong message to our kids. And that's that it's okay to own an owl for a pet. No. Okay? I'm from Oregon. I know. Owls are made of claws, feathers, and hatred. That's it. Like, owls don't give a crap. You ever look at an owl, the rage and hatred in his eyes? Up in a tree, like, who? Who? Who's next to die? It's you, mouse. Owl. And I'm back. Hating everything that lives. Hey. It's kind of like 101 Dalmatians. You remember when that movie came out and all the kids wanted Dalmatians for Christmas? Even though the Dalmatians are the most insane dog in dog land. They are. You throw a stick to a Dalmatian and come back with his own leg torn off. Yeah. Is that what you threw? I didn't even look. Ha ha! Dalmatian! They yell their own name like Geronimo.
They sure do. All right, that was Matt Bronger with a portion of a piece called Owls, taken from his Letterman debut some years ago. All right, this is as good a time as any for another animal song. John Vanderslice is, along with Alexander the Grapes, is playing tonight at New World Brewery, so we thought we'd hear an animal song from them. This is one called White Dove on Talking Animals.
On her veranda, we watched the ocean batter beneath a pine. Do you have any children around us change?
thinking of. We had a daughter, disappeared at eight. We gave them money, all we could do is wait.
All right, John Vanderslice with White Dove. Again, John Vanderslice and Alexander the Grapes holding for tonight at New World Brewery. Going to, at the end of the show here, play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to see Johnny Marr at the Beecham Theater in Orlando, November 25th. We'll get to that just in a moment or two, but want to get a few announcements, primarily locally oriented. So just first of all, overall, there's this thing called the black dog syndrome, where animal shelters have found over the years that black-coated pets end up waiting longer to get adopted, if they ever get adopted. There's always various incentives to adopt black animals. We've got two black cats at the house, and one of the all-time great animals in my life was a black cat, so we're particularly sensitive to that. So anyways, it's... various shelters have this called Back in Black, and it's usually for the month of November. And among others participating is the Maine Society of Tampa Bay. So they usually all kinds of cool deals for adopting, and plus you're just giving a new life to a nice animal. So you can go to MaineSocietyTampa.org for more on that. Speaking of the Maine Society of Pinellas is continuing with its second weekend of Photos with Santa, which you can bring your pets and family to get a keepsake. We'll help them as well. So this coming weekend, 16th and the 17th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., they'll be doing it at 3040 State Road 590 in Clearwater. You can find out more about that, HumaneSocietyOfPinellas.org. Looking ahead a little bit, want to remind you that the 8th Annual Thanks Vegan Feast is coming up. Of course, it's Thanksgiving Day. It's going to be at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa. So it's delicious, sort of potluck-style vegan feast. You'll find out more, either what you can bring, or if you're not inclined to bring or prepare something that day, how you can sort of still get in on it. So thanksvegan.com on the web, or thanksvegan on Facebook. Let's do Name That Animal Tune. So again, it is to give away. Do not need to be a WNF member. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to see Johnny Marr at the Beecham Theater in Orlando, November 5th. The first person who calls in the correct title of this animal song, 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune, sort of with our wildlife theme in mind as well, on Talking Animals.
Now somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like.
All right, we'll take those calls off the air as they come in. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, November 20th, when my guest will be Jane Hoffman, president of the Mayor's Alliance of New York City, collective of some 150 animal shelters and rescue groups with the mission of improving the lives of pets and their humans there. They're marking their 10th anniversary, so ideal time for a status update. You'll join us for that. Also, hope you'll go to TalkingAnimals.net, our Facebook page link and Twitter feed and more there. And it's all at TalkingAnimals.net. Duncan Strauss, thanks very much for listening. We're closing out today's show with an animal song of sorts by Sons of Hippies, partly as a nod to one of our favorite bands being in my old stomping grounds this week. They were in Orange County, my actual stomping grounds yesterday. Tonight they're performing in L.A., at the Silver Lake Lounge. So this is Sons of Hippies with Animal Battle on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.